I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian of the New York Society Library. And I just want to say this is the first that we have done a joint event with the London Library. I hope it is not our last. It's been really great getting to know all the folks at the London Library and to get to know Giles, too, who I met recently in London. And we're thrilled to have all of you here tonight. I think this is probably only the first time we can probably say this when comparing two institutions, a U.S. institution and a U.K. institution, that the London Library is actually a young whippersnapper compared to the New York Society Library. We are 87 years older than the London Library, founded in 1754. So we actually have a charter that was signed by King George III, and I think one of your members recently tweeted out that King George knew a good investment when he saw one. So, but we are really thrilled to have everybody here tonight. And I would now just like to turn the mic over to Philip Spedding, who's the Director of Development at the London Library.
As Caroline said, we at the London Library are the younger sibling, but very much part of a happy family, and delighted that Caroline and others from America came over recently to London for a small conference on the challenges of being a private library. We're going through challenges, as everyone else is, and we're very fortunate to have a group of trustees who are helping us through this particular maze. I'm very lucky that Giles is indeed one of those trustees, bringing energy and enthusiasm and ideas. Fortunately, you are lucky that tonight he's not talking about being a trustee of the London Library, although I'm sure he would make it very entertaining. But he's instead talking about the product of his day job, which is being one of the most engaging and illuminative history writers that we have in our country. He's going to talk tonight about Churchill, who was a member of the library. And there is still a member of staff alive who took his books across Horse Guards Parade into Downing Street during the Second World War. But we are not part of his Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. The London Library is very gentlemanly and ladylike. But I will speak no more and instead hand you over to the wonderful Giles Milton. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Philip. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for coming out on such a freezing night. I didn't quite realise New York was going to be this cold, but there we are. So, yes, I've written 11 works of history, all of them written in the London Library, which is the most fabulous place to work. And, of course, this book also was written in entirety in the London Library. So I want to take you into a story of wild creativity, of ingenuity, of dirty tricks, of sabotage, a story that involves some of the least known characters of the Second World War. It owes a great deal to this man here, Winston Churchill. And just to give a sort of flavour, we all know many of his witty phrases, but he said of his ministry, he said, "It's not just the good boys who win wars, but the cheats and stinkers as well." So I will be telling you about some of these cheats and stinkers. But it starts, our story tonight begins with this chap here. This is Robert Bower, and he was a Conservative Member of Parliament. And in the spring of 1940, he got up in Parliament and made a speech that somewhat shocked his parliamentary colleagues. It should be said he was a bit of a political maverick. He was prone to saying rather outrageous things. And just a year before, he'd insulted a Jewish backbencher who'd come over and punched him in the face on the floor of the House. So he was taking part in a debate in the spring of 1940. We're in the middle of the phony war. And they're debating how the war that everyone knows is coming, how it should be fought. And Member of Parliament after Member of Parliament stand up and express the feeling that there are rules to the Book of War and there are ways you should fight. You know, it's a bit like a game of cricket, really, or like boxing is governed by the Queensbury rules. You know, you don't punch a man who's down. Bower stood up to make his speech and he said, "This is ridiculous. When you are fighting for your life against a ruthless opponent," he says, "you cannot be governed by the Queensbury rules. We must have a government which will be ruthless, relentless, and remorseless. In short," he said, "we want a few more cads in this government. Now, what Robert Bauer didn't know, and what none of his fellow MPs knew, and what no one in the country at large knew, is that an organisation had already been established, and it was planning how to fight a war that was most certainly not governed by gentlemanly behaviour. This organisation was known as MIR, Military Intelligence Research, and its work was really so controversial, so shocking, and so potentially illegal that no one in the country was to know anything about it. It began, rather surprisingly, with this young lady here. She is called Joan Bright, and in the spring of 1939, we're rewinding a little bit here, she was a jaunty 29-year-old, and she was looking for work in London. She was very well connected, spoke a number of languages, and she'd actually been offered a job as governess to the children of Rudolf Hess in Germany. She didn't really want to do that, but she did want a job, and she told her friends she was looking for work in London. And one of them said something rather peculiar. He said that if she went to St. James's Underground Station at 11 o'clock on a certain day, wearing a pink carnation in her buttonhole, then there would be someone there to meet her and take her off for a job interview. Well, Joan did not quite know what to make of this. She thought perhaps it was all just a practical joke, but she went along there anyway with a carnation in her buttonhole, and sure enough, there was a lady waiting to meet her. And she took her off to this building here. This is now, and then, in fact, St. Ermin's Hotel. It's very near the Houses of Parliament, and it still looks exactly like that. It hasn't changed at all. As well as being a hotel, this was the headquarters of MIR, Military Intelligence Research. And Joan was led up to the fourth floor of this building, and she was interviewed by a military colonel. And he told her, she didn't know why she was there, what she was doing there. He told her that she was being interviewed for a job so secret that if she was ever captured by the Germans, she would be tortured. "You will," he said, "get needles in your toenails." Well, Joan thought she was coming for a secretarial interview. Was somewhat startled by this, but when this colonel slid a piece of paper across the desk, she was so nervous she signed it and gave it back again, and only then did she realise she'd just signed the Official Secrets Act. She had no idea what her job would entail. She knew absolutely nothing about her boss, and she was due to start in a week's time when she would finally meet this boss, and it is this chap here. His name is Colin Gubbins. He is a tough Scottish Highlander from the west coast of Scotland. He left school at 16. He went straight into the military, and he then fought in the First World War. And he fought a very hideous, brutal, nasty war on the Western Front in France and in Flanders. He saw many of his friends blown to pieces. He got deeply sick and was actually invalided out. And you would think that someone like Colin Gubbins would therefore not want to have anything more to do with war. Quite the contrary, Colin Gubbins was absolutely fascinated with the whole business of fighting, how you went about fighting a war. And what he particularly was interested in is how you might subvert the rules of war, tear up the rule book and do things differently. So far from leaving the military, he signed up for a tour of duty in Ireland, where he thought he might learn a few tricks. And he ended up doing battle against this chap here. This is, of course, Michael Collins, and here are some of his Sinn Féin revolutionaries. This was a really nasty war. It was bitter, it was unpredictable. And Gubbins complained about, he said, being shot at from behind hedges by men in trilbies and Macintoshes and not being allowed to shoot back. But he realised that irregular soldiers armed with makeshift weapons could actually wreak havoc on the regular army. And really, from this point on, he began to study all sorts of different means of fighting a war. And one who particularly inspired him, I think you will all recognise this chap here, Al Capone. The gangster, the great gangster of Chicago. Of course, his gangsters had attacked nightclubs, they'd caused mayhem and murder. And their success, realised Gubbins, was that they captured their victims unawares. They used surprise, they would strike suddenly, and then they would slink off into the night, before anyone could catch them. This was the hallmark of guerrilla warfare. They also, it should be said, were all armed with Tommy guns, a very efficient gun, and this became the weapon of choice for Colin Gubbins and his future saboteurs and guerrillas. So in the spring of 1939, Gubbins was asked to set up MIR, this organisation, Military Intelligence Research, and it was to plan a dirty war against Hitler, the war that everyone knew was coming. And what Gubbins did, he sat down and he wrote this book here, and this was to become a seminal work. It was a small book, a pamphlet really, and that set out for the first time ever how the British could fight and win an underhand and thoroughly ungentlemanly war against the Nazis. Gubbins knew that in 1939-1940, the British Army simply didn't have a chance against Hitler's war machine, which was, you know, mechanised, it was very well equipped. But he also realised that a mechanised army was much more vulnerable than first appeared, because it relied on fuel depots, it relied on communications networks, it relied on bridges, on viaducts, on all sorts of communications, which, you know, targeted with a very small amount of explosives, you could actually completely render this army immobile and unable to act. And so, for example, there's some very juicy tips in this. So, you know, if, for example, you'd like to destroy a factory, you do not blow up all the machinery. That's a complete waste of explosives. What he tells you to do here is single out one key thing on each machine and destroy that. And if you destroy them all, you've basically knocked the factory out of action, and it's very difficult to get the factory going again. Seems obvious, but people didn't think like that at the time. And if any of you on your way home tonight would like to bring down an electricity pylon, do not put explosives under all four legs, because what happens? The thing will slump down and carry on transmitting electricity. Put explosives under three legs and the thing will come crashing down and you've wiped out the power. It's good to know, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So it's a pretty brutal pamphlet when you read it. So here's a line from it. Gubbins was particularly into sabotaging train networks. It is not sufficient to shoot at the train, he says. First, derail the train and then shoot down the survivors. Now, this pamphlet was going to be issued to saboteurs and guerrillas who were going to go out behind enemy lines. It was absolutely crucial that the Germans didn't get their hand on this pamphlet. So dear Joan Bright, who we met at the beginning, she had it printed on edible paper, and it was said you could consume the entire pamphlet in 2 minutes if swallowed with a large glass of water. Now, the early months of the war, of course, have been marked by inaction, the so-called phony war, and then we come to May 1940, and Hitler's army sweeps into Holland, into Belgium, across France, and Britain is going to be next and is in a desperate state. And this is the very moment when Churchill, of course, is made Prime Minister. And he's expecting this Nazi invasion to come within a matter of weeks. He says, in a conversation with President Roosevelt, he says, "The scene has darkened swiftly. We expect to be attacked here ourselves, both from the air and by parachute and airborne troops in the near future. And we are getting ready for it." And he was getting ready for it in rather unorthodox fashion. Because just very soon after becoming Prime Minister, he took really the momentous decision to form the Special Operations Executive, SOE, which is to be a highly secretive organisation. And basically what he does, he takes the existing and very small MIR and makes it into something much, much bigger. And here is, just to give some idea of the scale, this is the headquarters of SOE, which is on Baker Street. It's the old, in fact, the old headquarters of Marks and Spencer's. Really, once Churchill is supporting this, unlimited amount of manpower and womanpower and money is poured into this organisation. Here is a very rare picture of the inside of the building. You can see on the wall there, you know, the enemy is listening. Churchill quipped, and I would like to claim the credit for the title of my book, but actually Churchill quipped that this was his ministry of ungentlemanly warfare, and it was a ministry which was, to use his famous words, it was to set Europe ablaze. Colin Gubbins was immediately put in charge. He was the acknowledged expert on this sort of warfare now, and his first task, was to start recruiting and training would-be guerrillas to be dropped behind enemy lines and to carry out the art of ungentlemanly warfare. And at this point, the story takes another surprising turn. Because as Colin Gubbins is recruiting for this organisation, two elderly gentlemen pitch up in London. They go and visit Colin Gubbins, and they say they would like to help. And they have the most extraordinary story to tell. One of the men is this chap here. He's called Eric Sykes. Everyone calls him Bill. He wears these thick pebble glass spectacles. He has a dimpled smile. And everyone says he looks like a lovely old gentleman. One of his friends said he had the manner and appearance of an elderly, amiable clergyman. He spoke in soft tones and had a benevolent smile. So he says to Colin Gubbins that he wants to help out in the war effort, whatever he could do to help. And Colin Gubbins can't help but suppress a smile, because look at him. I mean, he looks like somebody who could be in the Home Guard, you know, the so-called dad's army, patrolling suburbia with a pitchfork or a spade or something like that. But Eric Sykes has a story to tell. His previous employment has been in Shanghai, the most dangerous city in the world, and he's worked for two American companies, Colt and Remington. He was a crack shot. He was said to be the finest pistol shooter in the world, and his speciality was shooting from the hip. He was an expert in silent killing. He was chilling, he was ruthless, he was clinical, and he was a man whose every single sentence was said to end with the words, "and then kick him in the testicles." His comrade in arms is this chap, also come from Shanghai, William Fairbairn. He was also, when not in military uniform, he was also said to look like a vicar. His horn-rimmed spectacles and benevolent expression earned him the nickname the Deacon. Yet his sermon had a nasty sting in the tail. Kill or be killed, it was his catchphrase. So he had been in charge of the Shanghai riot squad. And alongside Eric Sykes, their task had been to track down and kill the gangsters in the most dangerous city in the world. And here we have I found this picture of some of those men. William Fairbairn, he set to the task in Shanghai with relish, really. He actually really enjoyed killing scores of criminals in the city. And when he came to see Colin Gubbins, he'd come out with phrases such as this. "In this war," he said, "you cannot afford the luxury of squeamishness. Either you kill or capture, or you will be killed or captured. We've got to be tough to win, and we've got to be ruthless." Now, this manner of talking absolutely appalled the senior British generals in the British Army, the chiefs of staff. They were horrified because they believed the old creed of, you know, fighting war like it was a game of cricket. Gubbins saw things rather differently. He thought these two chaps were exactly what he wanted for his new force, and he immediately hired them both, and they were sent up to a remote country house, hunting estate, in Arisaig, which is on the west coast of Scotland, not a million miles away from Skye. And they were set up to run a centre with the code name STS21, Special Training School 21. But for those who went there, everyone called it the Killing School. And this was the first training camp of SOE, the Special Operations Executive. And here is that house that they went to. It's an incredible place. It really is in the absolute middle of nowhere. And it's on its own estate. It's on this vast tract of wilderness. So no one knew what was taking place on this estate. Now, it's now a very nice luxury country hotel. And I took my wife there recently, about a year ago, and we had a wonderful time there. But I was rather surprised that dotted across the lawn were these brick cabins with a small front door and no windows, tiny little things. And I said to the owner, you know, what are these for? And she said, this is where they used to lock, the would-be saboteurs were locked into these places for 2 days without food or water, in darkness. And then they were pulled out and they were put through a Gestapo interrogation to see how they got on. So psychological training was as important as learning how to kill. Here's a picture of someone. This is how you kill somebody, by knifing them in the throat. They learned pistol shooting. They learned knife fighting. They learned survival. They learned how to strangle a sentry with piano wire. And as I say, psychological warfare was incredibly important. These were men being dropped behind enemy lines. It was dangerous. Now, on one occasion, Churchill came up to visit the killing school, and he brought with him Major General Sir Edward Spears, who was very much one of the old school of the British Army. And he listened to one of Fairbairn's lectures, and he was frankly appalled by what he heard. "This is monstrous," he said. "Don't pay any attention to this dreadful teaching. Remember, we're British. We do not stoop to thug element tactics. We do not stab in the back. We fight as men. We do not slash. Now this must cease." Well, Winston Churchill at this point slipped into the room. He was grinning wildly. By all accounts, he was rather the worse for wear. He'd had quite a few drinks on the way. And he grabbed Major General Sir Edward Spears and he said, "Oh, come on, Teddy, for Christ's sake, you've said enough. Come and have a drink." And he pulled Spears outside, popped his head back into the room, and he said, "Good work, keep it up." So life at Arisaig was exhausting, but the men, here's a rather nice group photo of some of the trainees, some of the first trainees to go through. They were always hungry. There was never enough food. So they discovered that rather than go out hunting with hunting rifles for the deer that patrolled all around the countryside there, it was so much easier to go with machine guns and just shoot them like that. So they very quickly picked up some ungentlemanly tricks. Also, salmon fishing. Why bother with a fishing rod and fly fishing and all that sort of stuff when you could just chuck explosives into the lock? It would kill all the fish and they'd float up to the surface. It was a great way to get a good dinner. Now, it was not long after the foundation of SOE that Colin Gubbins had a visitor from America. Colonel William Wild Bill Donovan, who, of course, I'm sure you will all know, had fought with great courage in the First World War, and he had been placed only recently in charge of the newly formed Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which is, of course, a very similar organisation to the British SOE. He comes to Britain. He meets with Gubbins on several occasions, in fact, and Gubbins takes him up to Arisaig to show him the killing school. And Wild Bill loves it. He thinks it's absolutely fantastic, and he wants a similar camp to be set up in North America where they can train would-be American saboteurs and guerrillas. But, of course, there's a slight problem here because America is not in the war. It's governed by the Neutrality Act. It simply cannot be seen to be training guerrillas on American territory. So what does Wild Bill do? Well, he decides to situate Camp X, as it is known, very bad photo, but it's the only one we have. This is situated in Canada on the shores of Lake Ontario. It's easily accessible, of course, from New York State, which is, you know, just on the other side of the lake. So Donovan's first batch of saboteurs and guerrillas are able to go there and begin their specialist training. Now, Donovan, he doesn't just want to set up a pale imitation of Arisaig House. He kind of wants it to be better. And so he says to Gubbins, you know, "Can I have Sykes and Fairbairn to come over and train the American guerrillas?" And Gubbins says, "Well, you can't have them both, but you can have one of them." And so Wild Bill goes back with William Fairbairn, who starts to teach the men in the dirty arts. And here he is, actually, training some of the men. Now, what he used to do, he was always unarmed, but he used to get the men, he used to give them a knife or a dagger and ask them to come and try and attack him. And no one ever got near him. He was just too good at defense. They could never get near him when they tried to attack, except for one chap called Jeffrey Jones, who is this huge, great, hulking American guy. And he comes at Fairbairn with his knife, and he sort of launches himself at him. And with his knife, he sticks it into Fairbairn's cheek and slashes his cheek wide open. I thought, Jesus Christ, I've done it now. He's going to kill me. But Fairbairn merely delighted him. He said he was delighted with Jones's skill. He was beaming broadly as he mopped up the blood from his cheek, and he said, "Good boy, well done." So, once America was then in the war, OSS underwent the same process as SOE. It was expanded greatly, and here is its headquarters. And, the men who are trained at the two camps, they are going to be involved in some of the most dastardly acts of the Second World War, some of the greatest acts of destruction. But you cannot carry out an operation like that without having bespoke specialist weapons. And so to look at where these weapons come from, we've got the trainees now, to look at where the weapons are going to come from, we need to head to an Edwardian country house some 40 miles to the north of London. And that is this house here. Now, I'm sure all of you have heard of Bletchley Park, the code-breaking centre. You will have seen The Imitation Game. You'll know all about it. Everyone in England also knows about Bletchley Park. Absolutely no one knows about the furs, because it was incredibly secret. It was requisitioned by Winston Churchill, and this became the principal centre for the invention and the manufacture of unorthodox weapons that were to be used on unorthodox operations. And it was to be led by a man every bit as extraordinary as Sykes and Fairbairn, another man who was to become one of the key figures in the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And here he is, here on the right of the picture. He's called Millis Jeffreys. He was simply brilliant. He had a brain that worked like a computer. He'd begun his life as a structural engineer in the army. And like so many who would join Colin Gubbins, he'd been sent out to British India, and he'd been working on the northwest frontier, a very dangerous part of British India to be. He was described as an outstanding man of rare inventive genius. Now, he had been designing roads and bridges and viaducts, and it was while he's up on the northwest frontier there that he had his sort of road to Damascus moment. He was suddenly struck by the value of sabotage, that if you blew up a bridge, you could stop an army in its tracks. If you blew up a power station, you deprived it of power, and it simply could be immobilized. And so as soon as Churchill got wind of his talents, he immediately gave him employment, brought him into the organization, and gave him the furs with which to set up his own unit. This unit was known as MD1, Ministry of Defence One. And of course, there was no Ministry of Defence at the time, but Churchill was Minister of Defence. So this enabled him to really creating his own private sabotage unit, financed by and supported by him, in which to carry out operations that no one would ever hear about. Here we have Churchill. In fact, a very rare picture with Churchill with Millis Jeffreys in the middle of the picture there, and Professor Lindemann, the prof, as Churchill called him, who was his scientific expert and advisor. And Churchill just loved to come down with his daughter to the furs at weekends and shoot off a few prototype weapons. And there's one wonderful occasion where Millis Jeffreys had invented an extraordinary missile, but it was a prototype, and Churchill said, "Oh, come on, let's fire it anyway." And in doing so, he almost took off de Gaulle's head. And he actually said, if only we'd aimed a bit more closely. Before long, Jeffreys had a team of brilliant individuals working for him. I just put this in because I love this picture of the sort of boffins, these sort of brilliant British eccentric geniuses who are brought in to design and build the nastiest bespoke weapons sort of ever invented. And many of them were in fact poached by the Americans and came over and worked on the Manhattan Project in the end. And here is a rather lovely picture. This is the team at the furs, and you'll notice something very interesting about this picture, and that is the number of women. Both Gubbins and Millis Jeffreys believed that women should be an integral part of everything that was going on. And so people like Joan Bright, who we met at the beginning, the women at the furs, they played an absolutely key role, as they did, of course, in Bletchley Park, in planning these dastardly operations. The work was hard. Jeffreys was a complete workaholic, worked 16 to 18 hours a day. But he had to because Churchill would give him near impossible orders. So when Millis Jeffreys invented this thing called the sticky bomb, this was an anti-tank weapon that would stick to a tank before exploding and thereby enhancing the force greatly, Churchill loved it and he simply sent a memo to Millis Jeffreys. It just simply said, sticky bomb, make 1 million. Now, one of my favourite characters in the entire book also ended up at the Furs, and it is this chap here, Cecil Clark. He was a caravan engineer, a trailer engineer from Bedfordshire, and he was forever dreaming up weird and wonderful machines, many of which incorporated this revolutionary prototype engineering that he'd invented, hydraulic suspension, all sorts of stuff. Here's one of his caravans, trailers here. Crazy sort of machines. He'd fought in the First World War in an explosives battalion, and one of his neighbours said he never lost the love of making loud bangs. He very quickly came to the notice of Colin Gubbins and Winston Churchill, who wanted him brought on board as soon as possible as a developer of unorthodox weapons, and unorthodox, believe me, they truly were. His first weapon was very homespun. It was built from items that he could buy in his local shops in the town of Bedford. He went to Woolworths and he bought himself a large metal bowl. He then went to Bassett's, the sweet shop, where he bought a bag of aniseed balls. He went to Boots, the chemist, and bought lots of condoms. And then he went off to Bedford swimming pool, where he tested his new weapon, which was designed with a metal bowl, some aniseed balls, and, of course, some plastic explosives. And what Cecil Clark had just invented was the limpet mine. This was one of the deadliest, the most effective weapons of sabotage of the entire Second World War. Packed with explosives and lined with magnets, you just had one diver had to swim underneath a ship, slap it on the underside, And here is the key about the aniseed balls. Cecil Clark had realised they dissolve with absolute regularity, so you knew exactly when it would set off the explosion. So the aniseed ball would melt, the thing would go off, and bang, your ship would go to the bottom of the sea. Here is a limpet mine being put onto a ship. But the beauty of the limpet mine was it couldn't just be used on ships. It could be used on anything that was made of metal. Turbines, power stations, anything. You could blow up, you know, all sorts of things. It really was. It became the most effective sabotage weapon of the Second World War. It was used on countless operations, and it was responsible for the sinking of, you know, hundreds of ships. Why the condoms? Someone asked me. Well, the problem is, Cecil Clark was making these things and then had to store them. And the problem is, if you have an aniseed ball that is liable to dissolve, if there's any damp in your storehouse, you're going to have the whole thing going up and blowing up. But Cecil Clark realised that condoms were perfect because if you pulled them over this thing, tied them tightly, they were kept completely damp-free and watertight. And so what he ended up doing, him and a friend ended up walking up and down Bedford High Street, going into every pharmacy, buying up all their stock of condoms and earning himself, he said, an undeserved reputation for being a sexual athlete. There is plenty more about the men in my book, the key men in the book. There are many more eccentrics like Cecil Clark, and much more about the weaponry and the training that they underwent. But, you know, let's look at one operation, because you probably want to know what they actually did. Well, this chap here is Reinhard Heydrich. He was the Reichsprotector of Bohemia and Moravia, and he was Hitler's favourite. He was a monster. He was known to Czechs as the Butcher of Prague. He had killed thousands of Czechs in his tenure. He was rounding up many more every day. Dozens of Czechs were being killed. And he made a most enticing target for the government, the Czech government in exile, which, of course, was in London at the time. They were also coming under immense pressure from Stalin to do something inside their country. So they chose the biggest fish in town. But here he is, Heydrich, in Prague. How on earth do you kill somebody like this? The Czechs simply didn't know, so they turned to Colin Gubbins, who by now had a certain expertise in killing, in sabotage, in dirty tricks. And the first thing that Gubbins did was find out more about where he lived, what his daily routine was. Heydrich lived in a castle outside the city, but he worked inside the city, and he came in every day. He drove into the city, and he took the same route on every single occasion. He travelled in a car. Well, you see the car here, but here's one of the cars at the time. It was an armour-plated Mercedes. And this, really, when the roof is closed and it's being driven at high speed, it's very difficult to blow up a car like this, even a convertible. But there was one important fact that Colin Gubbins noticed as he studied the route into Prague that Heydrich took every day. As the car entered the city, it had to go around this hairpin bend. This is an immensely sharp hairpin bend. And Colin Gubbins realised that the car would have to slow down to not more than 15 miles an hour. And he realised this was the place they had to strike. This was the best place they would get to hit and take out Reinhard Heydrich. But you need a weapon. And for a weapon, you need Cecil Clarke. He's now on board as one of the top weapons designers, and he sets himself a task of designing a bomb that was small enough to be thrown across the road, but powerful enough to blow through an armour-plated Mercedes. This is a tall order. And his idea was to try and hit the car from underneath so that the weapon would explode upwards and force shrapnel into Heydrich's body. So he took anti-tank percussion grenade here on the left of the picture. This is enormous. I mean, you can't chuck one of these across the road. It's really heavy. So he slims it right down to this one on the right here, packs it with nitroglycerine, and then he put the key thing. He puts this thing called a number 247 fuse onto this bomb. This means that wherever this thing lands when it's thrown, wherever it lands, it will blow up. So it will go off. It is possible that Cecil Clarke had a fondness for biological warfare, and he was in touch with Porton government laboratories who were developing biological warfare at the time, and it is possible, but we don't know, that he also laced this with a biological agent. This is actually a picture from the archives of the Gestapo. So we have a plan, we have a target, we have a weapon. And now we need some assassins. Here they are. Joseph Gabczyk on the right of the picture here. He was a really a fiery patriot, very hot-headed. He was desperate to take part in this mission. The Czechs in Britain, they really wanted to do something. And here's Jan Hubis on the left. He's a sort of antidote. He's very shy. He's very calm, a tempered individual. They are taken up to Arisaig House, up to the killing school, and they are taught to practice on knocking out Heydrich's Mercedes. And they use Cecil Clarke's car. And this is his car, and it's a Canadian Buick. And believe it or not, Cecil Clarke has bought this from King Edward VIII, who sold it after he abdicated. Now, try as they might, these two Czechs simply could not hit the car with this weapon. And one of the Brits training them said that he thought it was because they had not been reared in a cricketing tradition. They eventually got the hang of it. I should actually say, I was filming a TV program recently with a British actor called David Jason, and we were reenacting the assassination. And we had an old car, and we were going to blow it up. Thought it would look good on TV. But it was a controlled explosion. It was a very small explosion, or so it was meant to be. When the actual explosion went off, the two doors of the car were flung 300 feet in either direction, and the car was left as a mangled wreck. And David Jason, professional actor as he is, for any of you who've watched The Italian Job, he looked straight at the camera and said, "You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off." So at the end of December 1941, our two assassins, they board a plane, and, well, they get up to all sorts of adventures. All sorts of things go wrong, as you can imagine, on an operation like this, parachuting into, you know, in the winter in Czechoslovakia. But eventually, on the 27th of May, they are to be found at that crossroads at the entrance to Prague. And as Heydrich comes into view, the car, as Gubbins had promised, it slows down to 15 miles an hour. And Kubis steps out of the shadows, and he throws his bomb at the car, and he misses. But As Cecil Clark had intended, this bomb would go off wherever it landed, and it landed, as you can see here, just behind the back wheel. So actually, it wasn't a million miles off from what they were meant to do, and it exploded with unbelievable violence, and it flung shrapnel, metal, and horsehair from the seat deep into Heydrich's body. And, well, a few days later, Heydrich died, killed by blood poisoning from the contaminated shrapnel and possibly from the biological agent that might have been in the weapon. Hitler, of course, was livid. He ordered reprisals, and they were reprisals so terrible that many questioned, you know, was it really worth doing this operation? Innocent civilians were gunned down. The Czech government in exile argued that Heydrich was killing hundreds of people every day, innocent Czechs, and the man had to be eliminated. And I think they felt they just had to do something. One little postscript on this story is that sometime afterwards, President Roosevelt met with Churchill and he asked if the British had been involved in any way in the assassination of Heydrich. And Churchill merely smiled at him and winked. He felt that there were some things that he couldn't even say to the American president. Let me just give you a few more operations that they carried out. So these are the U-boat pens on the Atlantic coast of France. From these U-boat pens, the U-boats were going out and, of course, attacking the Atlantic convoys with devastating effect. Now, look at the scale of them, the size of them, the amount of concrete in them. You simply cannot destroy one of these from the air, however much, you know, explosive bombs you put on them. They will not be crippled, basically. So what does Cubbins do? Well, obviously, he's always thinking outside the box. Don't attack this. Attack the power station that supplies all the electricity for this. And so that is exactly what happens. Pessac power station nearby is infiltrated by some of his saboteurs, and they use Cecil Clark's limpet mine to wipe out the power station and deprive this place of power for some weeks, so giving some breathing space for the convoys in the North Atlantic. Another great attack, was the attack on the dry dock of Saint-Nazaire. Now, Hitler's biggest battleship was called the Tirpitz, and it was a devastatingly powerful vessel. And the Allies reasoned, with good reason, that Hitler would only deploy this in the North Atlantic if he had access to the dry dock of Saint-Nazaire, the only dry dock big enough on the Atlantic coast to service the Tirpitz if it got damaged. If they couldn't use that, they'd have to come up the English Channel to German ports, and that would be obviously exposing the Tirpitz to great danger. The Allies, the Gubbins, hatches a plan to attack the dry dock, and it was an amazing operation using this ship here. The Campbelltown was to ram into the gates of the dry dock and then get stuck there. And the saboteurs would come out and they would attack the port, which they duly did. But the Germans couldn't quite understand, you know, what were the Allies doing ramming a ship into the dock, which was, the gates were clearly never going to give way with the force of the power of one ship. So about 2 hours after it had been stuck there, hundreds of Germans come on board, curious to see what was taking place. And of course, there was a nasty little surprise because there was a time delay bomb and it blew up and it killed all the Germans on board. It blew out the dock gates and it completely destroyed the dry docks. And in fact, I don't think they were repaired until about 1948. So it was a nasty but successful operation. This one is the destruction of the Gorgopotamus Viaduct. Now, in the early days of the war, when the war is being fought in the deserts of North Africa, all the weapons being used by the Afrika Korps, by the German army in North Africa, were coming from Germany, and they were coming by rail down through Europe, down to Piraeus Harbour in Greece, and then they were shipped across the Mediterranean to the army fighting in North Africa. What does Gubbins decide to do? Take out the key viaduct that crosses these wild, remote mountains in Greece and bring down the viaduct. Here's a band of men that did it, Brits and Greeks. They bring down the viaduct. Fantastic operation. And there were 50 trains a day going across this viaduct. So at a most critical period for the battle in North Africa, Rommel was deprived of 2,000 trainloads of supplies before they managed to get it up and running again. Another one, Norse Kaiju. This is a famous operation. This was the plant that was producing heavy water. If Hitler wanted to produce an atomic bomb, he needed heavy water, and this was the only place in Europe that manufactured heavy water. The RAF had tried to attack it from the air. They'd failed miserably. The commanders had gone in. They'd all been captured and killed. And then it is given over to Colin Gubbins, who decides that an operation like this has to be carried out by Norwegians. They're the only people that can possibly carry out an operation undercover in Norway. And it is run by this chap here, Joachim Ronnenberg, who incidentally only died a few months ago. Look how young he is. They were sent in, parachuted in. They had to scale this unbelievable cliff. They had to break into the factory. They had to attach Cecil Clark's explosives to the key parts of machinery. And then they had to get back down again and get out alive. And this was an absolutely brilliant work of sabotage. They totally destroyed the heavy water plant inside the factory. And indeed, when the German general, General von Falkenhorst, came to look at the damage, he simply smiled and he said, "This is the finest work of sabotage that I've ever seen." They got back to England. Of course, the hallmark of a good operation, sabotage operation is not only do you blow the thing up, but you get back home alive. And they all got home alive. Amazing operation. As was this one here. The Peugeot factory in France was the largest industrial plant in Europe. It employed 60,000 people, and it was no longer turning out Peugeot cars and Citroëns. It was turning out Nazi munitions. Again, the RAF tried to bomb it. They missed the factory completely. They managed to hit all the villages round about, killing quite a lot of French people, but missing the factory completely. Harry Ray says he can get in there with some explosives, and he does just that. He breaks into the factory with a few factory workers and he plants explosives on all the key machinery and blows the place up, puts it out of action. Fantastic operation. And it should be said, one of the key components in the factory was completely destroyed. It took the Germans three, 4 months to get a replacement. While it was sitting in the yard waiting to be installed, Harry Ray came in again and blew that one up as well. A final operation to take you through. This is a great one. And this is where Wild Bill Donovan re-enters the picture, because in the days, in the weeks before D-Day, him and Gubbins have hatched a plan to use joint teams of American and British saboteurs and guerrillas. And their job is really to stop the German army being able to bring up reinforcements into the Allied beachhead that they hope they're going to carve out on the coastline of Normandy at the time of D-Day. They were to blow up railways, they were to blow up bridges, they were to kill senior Nazis, all that, all the usual sort of stuff. And one of the key individuals was this young chap here, Tommy McPherson. His unenviable task was to prevent the mighty 2nd SS Panzer Division, Das Reich, from getting to Normandy. It was based in central France. It had 200 heavy tanks, it had 15,000 men, and most of them had served on the Eastern Front. These were serious professional soldiers. Well, here we are again, Das Reich en route. So what does Tommy McPherson do? Well, he's been trained at Arisaig House. He knows exactly what to do. You'll probably, many of you will have been to France, and you know these country roads with, you know, lined with trees all the way down for miles on end. They simply brought down tree after tree after tree after tree, blocking the route. All the routes going north, they blocked them. And when they brought down the trees, they then booby-trapped them. So when the Germans tried to push them out of the way with bulldozers, they blew up. And when they tired of that, they'd have other ones where they bring down trees, and then they'd have saboteurs, the Mackie would come out and shoot them down and then slink away again, just like Al Capone had done in Chicago. The Das Reich SS Panzer Division should have taken about 24 to 36 hours to reach Normandy. It could have been, presented a serious challenge to the Allied landings. But thanks to Tommy McPherson and his men, it took fully 17 days before they actually arrived in Normandy. So lastly, what did it all achieve? Well, over to General Eisenhower, and he is only talking about D-Day here. He said that the saboteurs had succeeded in imposing more or less serious delays on all divisions moved to Normandy, German divisions. This prevented Hitler from striking back in the crucial opening hours of Operation Overlord. And he singled out Tommy McPherson and his comrades for particular praise. He said, "The most outstanding example was the delay to the 2nd SS Panzer Division. This and other guerrilla actions, said Eisenhower, played a very considerable part in our complete and final victory. The war comes to an end, and sadly, in Britain, the government changes, Churchill's no longer in power, and SOE is disbanded. There's no money to keep it going, and very little enthusiasm with the new government that's come in. Churchill wants to, but no. But you Americans had a rather more enlightened approach. The OSS was expanded, it was enhanced, it was enlarged, and it became, of course, the CIA. And what I like to think is very few people in my country, and I suspect very few people in yours, know that the CIA has a very unusual pedigree, that the story of guerrilla warfare, of sabotage, of dirty tricks and special operations all began in the spring of 1939 with that sprightly young lady, Joan Bright, going for her job interview at St. Ermine's Hotel in London. And that was the beginning of Winston Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. I don't know if anyone has any questions. I shall try try and answer them. I don't know if you have. Or oh, yes, there's a question there. Yes.
But the origins of this, in fact, were before the British operation against the Ottoman Empire in doing sabotage on the Ottoman trains. So I wonder if you found any references from 1939-40 about British traditions in the Middle East. That's where it started. The Sykes-Picot was a big thing of British and French carving up the Middle East.
Yes. Yeah, well, I'm not sure about Eric Sykes, actually, but I do know that when Joan Bright arrived for her first day of work, the first book she saw was Lawrence of Arabia's book. So definitely Colin Gubbins was using that as one of the many reference books to plan his campaign of, you know, sabotage and dirty warfare. It should be said, that, and this comes up actually in a different book I wrote, that Churchill himself was a real enthusiast for chemical and biological weaponry, which seems very shocking to us today. But his argument was that there's very little difference between killing somebody with a machine gun and killing them with a chemical agent. Indeed, he argued that perhaps it was more humane to use chemical agents. Now, Churchill was Minister of War in Minister of Munitions. In 1919, when the British had landed in the in Russia, in northern Russia, and they were fighting against the Bolsheviks, and they the British had developed a very nasty chemical weapon in the at the very tail end of the First World War, so late in the war that it couldn't be used, and so Churchill said, "Well, let's use it against the Bolsheviks." So, believe it or not, the British shipped out 50,000 of these chemical warheads, and they indeed used them against the Bolsheviks. And because they didn't know the effect of them, they sent out a team of doctors and physicians to study what happened to anyone who inhaled this. It was like a very powerful form of gas that had been already used on the Western Front. And I found the file in the National Archives in London, and believe me, it's pretty horrific reading. I mean, they were coughing up blood and all sorts of things before they actually died. So a lot of this stuff was going on behind the scenes, and so Colin Gubbins was really taking it to a more professional level, and I think really, you know, the special operations we see today is really born out of this organisation. Yes, sir. Well, the Jedburghs were coming in. Their main operation really was carried out just before D-Day, and so they have very much been written out of the story, I think. We hear very little about the sabotage that was taking place, but it was absolutely critical because the whole point of Rommel, who was in charge of the German army in northern France, his whole defence was based on the idea of getting German troops rapidly into the Allied beachhead that he knew they'd be able to carve out and pushing them back into the sea while they were still seasick. They just landed, they were disorientated. You know, it was vital to bring in the panzer divisions in the early hours of the invasion on the 6th of June. The problem was that Rommel did not have authority over the panzer divisions. Hitler alone could launch the panzer divisions into action. And what had happened on the night of the 5th of June is that Hitler had taken a very powerful sleeping tablet, and he was fast asleep, and no one dared wake him up. And so it wasn't until midday that the first of the panzers were brought into action, by which point it was too late. And also, they suffered greatly from bridges had been blown up, railway lines had been destroyed. So I think that it's something that's worthy of greater study is the role that the saboteurs, and you know, the Jedburghs were usually, they were teams of three, one Brit, one American, one Frenchman, and they went in like that. And many of them, they were there for weeks on end. You know, it wasn't just in the immediate days before and after D-Day, they were there for months afterwards. So yeah, it's an interesting thing that needs to be more written about, I think. Yes, sir, and then you.
For anybody who's seen Break of Morant, I'm just curious to what extent Churchill got exposed to a lot of guerrilla activity in the Boer War, so that, in fact, he saw how effective that was and figured, you know, this is for me.
I think you're absolutely right. Certainly that was a very nasty war, and I think, he certainly brought his experiences of that to, you know, he loved talking with Gubbins. They met regularly and with the prof, Professor Lindemann, to discuss these things. Actually, from the book I'm researching at the moment, I was just reading about Churchill going to make his Fulton Iron Curtain speech and travelling on the train with Truman, and he was regaling Truman with tales of what he got up to in the Boer War. So it made an impact. How much, I don't know, but I'm sure it did. Yes. Yes, Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, Ian Fleming worked with these guys, so he was absolutely involved in it. And not only Ian Fleming, but Peter Fleming, his brother, who is a much better writer. he was in charge of it. So when Churchill was convinced that Hitler was going to invade, well, the invasion was planned. Operation Sea Lion was completely worked out, Hitler's invasion of the British Isles in the summer of 1940. But Peter Fleming, Ian's brother, was put in charge of the auxiliary units. This was a guerrilla unit, which, working on the supposition that Hitler's troops would be able to establish a beachhead, they were going to infiltrate that beachhead and try and destroy it from within. So the Fleming family were totally immersed in this stuff. And many people asked Ian Fleming, you know, who's James Bond based on? He would never say it was one particular individual. But, I mean, many of the characters in my book could have been role models for James Bond, that's for sure. Yes, sir.
What happened to Joan Bright?
Joan Bright had an absolutely fascinating war, actually. I mean, she left Colin Gubbins reasonably early on and went to work directly for Churchill in the cabinet war rooms. And she was, because she spoke very lots of languages, she was extremely well connected. She ended up going to Yalta, she went to Potsdam, she did all at Tehran, she covered all the conferences with Churchill, played a very distinguished role, and only died a few years ago at an absolutely ancient age, 102 or something like that. So, yes, really the last of this generation are leaving us now. There's very, very few left. But Colin Gubbins' club, the Special Operations Club, still exists in London. And if you go there of an evening, you sometimes see very elderly ladies at the bar drinking their gin and tonics. But I think that's probably all there. Well, thank you again very much for coming out. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. So you're one you would working on now then? So this is Berlin after the war.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a story of the four commandants and whose personal relationships turned sour. And their personal relationships kind of mirror the geopolitical thing that's going on. So I'm telling the story at the beginning of the Cold War through these four people.
But that's what you do so brilliantly, is you tell the story through the
yes.
people.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
people.